Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabake. First and most importantly, allow us to officially extend an invitation to the very first News and Brews Happy Hour.
Woo!
It's happening. It's happening this Thursday, June 23rd at 4:30 p.m. in Washington, D.C. at Soft House Beer Garden on 18th Street near DuPont Circle. As you know, we love hearing from listeners, incorporating conversations we have in the real world into the show, and we can't wait to connect with you over some real-life brews.
In the meantime, for our main story today, we'll get back to our old friend, the economy. Inflation, interest rate hikes, no lions or tigers, but definitely a bear market. There's a lot to take in there, and we'll help unpack it.
We also go on a global tour de news and brews, which takes us first to Colombia, where a Black woman has been elected to the vice presidency and a leftist former guerrilla will ascend to the presidency for the first time in that country's history. We'll also check in on Ukraine, where war drags on, EU accession could be on the horizon, global food markets are screwed, and Finland and Sweden could join the ranks of NATO. At least they will if Turkey's leaders can find a way to get their feelings unhurt.
Hashtag unhurt Turkey. You missed one thing, which is the part about the January 6th hearings.
They are
still going on and even uncovering new crimes as they go. It's like a scratch-off lottery ticket where democracy loses.
On that uplifting note, let's get into it.
Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you.
You too. Happy News and Brews recording day.
Happy News and Brews recording day. We're recording the day after Juneteenth. Did y'all do anything special for the long weekend?
Not really. I mean, we did start a new Father's Day tradition, which is family.
Oh yeah, there was that too.
Family wiffle ball.
Ooh.
So that was quite fun. I think we'll try to keep that going.
Like in your yard, or you like went to a park?
So about a block away from our house, there is this big empty lot that is owned by DC Metro because it includes like an access tunnel for maintenance to get down to the Metro tunnel. And so it's this huge open yard that, like, for our kids who are still young, is like a great size. Just go and run around. We can bring the dog and do whatever. So we did it there.
That's like a very urban story. Is there like, does hot air rise from a vent?
There's a vent on the property. Yeah.
That's really funny. I've never seen that. We did everything we could to stay outside as much as possible.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
It was really gorgeous. For those not in DC, it was sort of like in the 60s and 70s. It was just insane. We tried to eat every meal outside. We went on long bike rides, and it was pretty great.
Nice. What about this week? You have anything going on Thursday afternoon?
I was thinking about going to happy hour. You want to join?
The News and Brews happy hour.
Oh, the News and Brews happy hour. That's what it is. We are going to be going to the Soft House Beer Garden just off DuPont Circle here in Washington, D.C. At what time?
4:30.
4:30 p.m. That's 16:30 for you Europeans.
Everyone leave work early.
Everyone leave work early to come drink German beers with us. I'm sure they'll have other beers too, but it's a German beer garden. So, you know, when in Berlin.
Yeah. Lots of indoor space, lots of outdoor space. We're ready for anything. It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be great. See you there. And bonus, Ilana's going to be there.
That's right. Producer extraordinaire of News and Brews. Ilana will be joining us. So
the biggest draw, probably the biggest draw.
If the news wasn't enough and the brews weren't enough, you know, I think that everyone should be convinced now.
What are you drinking tonight?
I am. So I don't quite know how this is going to interact with our beer hall happy hour, but I am in a mode of reducing my carb intake per the doctor's orders. So I will be, for the rest of our recordings this summer, cycling through some great low carb brew options. This one is a High Noon. High Noon makes like a canned vodka soda, basically. And they're quite good. Like the balance of of alcohol to liquid to flavor is really nice with these. This is a black cherry.
Not too sweet?
Not too sweet. They're not really sweet at all. It's just smooth. It's nice.
Okay. Request on Thursday. Please don't order until I get there because I really, really want to be there when you order a non-beer beer from
the German Beer Garden. Yeah, Thursday might have to be a cheat day.
I have Atlas Brew Works Dance of Days, one of my favorite Lovely. Pale ales. Realized that we were low on beer this weekend, and so we quickly remedied that. And I saw that they had Dance of Days, which is a go-to favorite. Actually, I first had this at Trist, the coffee shop that turns into kind of a, you know, happy hour place in the afternoon, and loved it. And so it's been on the rotation ever since.
Excellent. Well, should we talk about the news?
Let's talk about the news. I want to start this week. We try to start sometimes with good news stories. And like all of our stories, there's probably elements of good and bad. But this one, let's go to Colombia first. So Colombia had the second round of its presidential election this year. They sort of do a runoff. If no one candidate gets 50% of the vote, then they'll do a second round. And so the second round was this weekend. And they made history in multiple ways, the most important of which I personally think is in electing its first Black vice president, Francia Marquez. The country's Afro-Colombian population is huge and, as you can probably guess, historically marginalized. So Marquez herself is an activist. Apparently she was a former housekeeper. Wow. Definitely sort of comes from, you know, sort of the lower socioeconomic demographic in Colombia. You know, politics aside, I don't know much about her politically, but politics aside, representation matters. And so congratulations to Francia Marquez and to Colombia. Her running mate and the person who will become Colombia's next president is a leftist, 62-year-old former guerrilla Gustavo Petro. So Mr. Petro beat out conservative Rodolfo Hernandez in a runoff election. Definitely got a majority. You know, all you need is 50% plus one, but it certainly wasn't a landslide. The Rodolfo Hernandez comes from the right and had a not particularly great campaign, but only got 47 or 48% of the vote, all said and done. So I'm excited that we're talking about Colombia because my last trip before the pandemic was in January 2020 to Colombia. And their last presidential election was in 2018. And so I learned a little bit about that. But I remember sitting in the Marriott in Bogota and being absolutely terrified. And actually, I was terrified that I wouldn't make it home in time for my second child to be born. I knew that there was this airborne virus that had come out of China, but it wasn't, you know, as much on the radar that that would be the global disruptor that it was. I was actually really concerned about getting back for Evren's birth, which thankfully I did. Evren was born on February 20th, 3 weeks before the lockdown. And so all's well that ends well. But I bring that up in part because while I was there doing research, I was sort of researching post-peace process. I'll talk about the FARC peace process in a second, but post-peace process, like how are we doing? How is stabilization going? You know, is there peace, et cetera? What are the fissures? And I wrote something on this that I'm happy to put in the show notes. As part of that, I met a presidential candidate from 2018. He actually got third in 2018. His name is Sergio Fajardo. This time around, he got fourth in the first round, so he wasn't in that runoff. I don't have a dog in the fight in Colombian politics necessarily, but I did really like the fact that Fajardo was, he campaigned on a sort of being a pragmatic politician with no particular ideology per se. And he wasn't part of the, like Colombia has very established parties. And I just came away from my meeting with him thinking like, wouldn't that be nice to actually have a multi-party system beyond just two main parties? I also really liked him because he was mayor of Medellin, and the reason I really liked him was he was a professor at La Universidad de los Andes, where he taught mathematical logic. But back to 2022, basically, Petro got pretty close in 2018, like closer than anybody thought he would. And so when we were researching, I came away thinking that like he was basically like a left of Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders. And it's not just because he's like in his 60s and has like kind of like wild hair. Politically speaking, like ideologically speaking, he's certainly left. So he and Marquez won in part by driving up voting in poor and neglected parts of the country, where their messages of social justice, economic inclusion, environmental protection, climate change, presumably those really resonated. Mm-hmm. They have an interesting electoral system, Mike. I don't know how much. First of all, have you followed this at all?
No, I've followed the fact that the election was happening. I knew who Petro was and kind of his general orientation, but I don't really know anything about the ins and outs of their system or what the run up to this was like. So this is all fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting system because after 2015, they basically did away with like their strict term limits. Like if you're president for 4 years, you can only be president for 4 years, which kind of seems like a little extreme to me. Like, can you imagine if we went through 2 years of campaigning for president and then like, nope, there's no incumbency or anything and just off we go into a new election. That's what they do every 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Virginia does with their governor, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Except they vote in like weird off years, right? That's
true.
Something funny about Virginia.
But yeah, I mean, it makes more sense. I don't know what their political culture is like. If you are in a reasonable world where the campaign starts like a few months before the election, it's probably not that bad. If you're in the US where the campaign starts 6 years in advance, like that's not so great.
I think it's in Colombia, it's somewhere in between. And so the current president is a guy named Iván Duque. He comes from the right. And so I think it's really easy to sort of interpret Petro's victory as a refutation of everything that was Duque's presidency. And honestly, that might be somewhat accurate. However, I think from my own research, I think it's worth noting that Duque made some really tough decisions, especially on the peace process. So in 2016, this sort of long-running civil war, essentially, between the FARC rebels and the guerrillas and the central government came to an end with a peace deal. And he, Iván Duque, opposed it, mainly because he thought it was way too lenient on the guerrillas. And a lot of people thought that at the time. And so when he came into office, he was faced with this like really tough decision. Like, do I go back on this? Like, we have peace for the first time. It's kind of a weird peace and maybe it's too lenient, but at least it's peace. So he actually didn't. He implemented it. And even though he campaigned saying that he wouldn't. So, I mean, look, he put a stamp on it. It's like sort of more national security focused, his implementation, but he did implement it, for which I think he deserves credit. So last thing on this, after decades, basically, Colombia's entire history basically has had right of center parties at the helm. And the pendulum as of this last weekend has swung about as far in the opposite direction as possible for the first time in history. Petro has campaigned and said that he wants to vastly expand the social safety net. Again, think sort of Bernie Sanders, but even more. All with a Congress that doesn't exactly strike me as, you know, friendly. They already have a huge fiscal deficit. So it's sort of like, where is this going to come from? And rising inflation, which is of course hitting us all. And I know we're going to talk about that later. That inflation has in large part led to the plummeting of popularity of other leftist political leaders who were not able to live up to their rhetoric in Chile and Peru. So I wish Mr. Petro buena suerte.
Yeah, so you described him as someone to the left of Bernie Sanders. Like, do you have a sense of what his... I know he's against oil drilling, for example, and really has an equity focus in his governing philosophy. I've also heard like a lot of hand-wringing on the right in this country about having more leftist leaders in South America, you know, including Gabriel Boric in Chile, who you mentioned and who we've talked about on the show before, concern about that sparking, you know, more migration north and into the US, concern about that generally destabilizing things. I mean, obviously you've got the specter of Venezuela and Cuba and other leftist regimes who have been hugely destructive in South America and Latin America. What's your sense of sort of the platform he is coming in with and where he sits relative to what we would think of as like the mainstream, you know, center left versus extreme socialism or communism?
The reason that I put him to the left of even Bernie Sanders is because I think he thinks the entire system is totally broken, which I think Bernie Sanders thinks the system is mostly broken. But I think like Colombia's economy is smaller and it's more heavily dependent on kind of export, you know, natural resources, kind of illicit economies like coca production still thrive. Like there's a bunch of fundamental problems with the economy that have led to just incredible wealth gaps. It is the most unequal country in, I believe, the hemisphere. I think even more than us. Like the inequality in Colombia is really staggering. And I think he's basically like, nope, we're going to stop all of that like extractive stuff. We're going to focus on renewables. We're going to redistribute, you know, taxes to poor people, and we're going to, you know, vastly expand the social safety net. And again, it's like all these things that sound personally, I think sound pretty good in terms of, you know, providing people the assistance that they need to live human lives and dignity. But it's like, you know, from a fiscal perspective, it's really hard to imagine, given the constraints that I mentioned, how would that even, like, how would you even do that?
Yeah, right. Which I think is reminiscent of what Boric is facing in Chile as well, where they've got a multi-party system and a lot of opposition and you know, Congress needed to be involved in big decisions that get made. But we'll see what happens and hope for good outcomes in Colombia.
Definitely.
Right, let's talk about the January 6th hearings. Last time we got together, we were hot on the heels of the first public hearing, a primetime extravaganza, lots of news, primetime production values, shareable content. As we record today, it's about 4 p.m. on Tuesday. The fourth hearing is in progress right now. In some very important ways, the hearings have created real news and real momentum. There was a concern going in that we sort of knew everything that there was to know about January 6th. And that is very clearly not true. There's been a lot of news. We called it a drip tease in our last episode, both, you know, releasing news through the hearings and teasing that there is more to come. So I wanted to share some of the big revelations from the last couple of hearings, the second and third one especially. We learned that Ginni Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, was more involved than we even knew from her leaked text to Mark Meadows that came out before the hearings. She hinted in one text that she had discussed the plot to overturn the election with her husband. Ooh. We learned that she was working directly with John Eastman, the hack lawyer who drafted the whole plan for Pence to unilaterally declare Trump the winner. And there's now some expectation that the committee will call her in to testify.
Wow.
As for John Eastman himself, we learned that he did ultimately acknowledge that his plan was a violation of the Electoral Count Act and even said as much to Donald Trump on January 4th, which, having checked my calculations, occurred before January 6th.
And had how much of an impact on Donald Trump's reactions?
Well, I think all of this, you know, between the advice he was getting from Bill Barr and other lawyers on his team, and now we know John Eastman as well, going to his mindset that he knew that what he was doing was illegal and was against the rules.
Which matters, because that gets to intent. And I'm no Southern lawyer like you, Mike Heslin, but, you know, intent matters.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Eastman also sent Rudy Giuliani an email that has spawned some excellent memes saying, I've decided I should be on the pardon list if that's still in the works. So appreciate that. He was not, in fact, on the pardon list when it came down to it.
It's good to know that he has decided that, though.
Last week, we learned that the mob on January 6th got within 40 feet of Vice President Pence and that his life was unequivocally in danger. In the hearing today, which is still in progress as we record, we learned that Ron Johnson, one of our favorite senators from Wisconsin, was actively trying to pass fraudulent slates of fake electors to Vice President Pence in advance of the electoral count.
Can I say something quick about Mike Pence?
Yeah.
Without including any qualifier, Mike Pence acted really bravely on January 6th. Period.
Is that it?
That's it.
Yeah. So there was this article that came out in The Atlantic a week or two ago saying that Mike Pence is a hero and that Biden should award him the Medal of Freedom and that we should name congressional buildings after him and all this sort of gushing that made me like scream and throw up a little bit in my mouth.
Yeah, I don't know about all that, but he did act bravely on January 6th.
Yeah, I think we have to hold two things in our mind simultaneously, which is that, you know, Mike Pence holds some really abhorrent views and advocates some really awful policies and even has said like this week that he's never seen as much lying from a president in his lifetime as he sees from Joe Biden, while also
statement.
While also acknowledging that he did do a really brave thing, as you said, on January 6th, and that there are a lot of members of the Republican Party, including a lot of elected officials who we are learning would not have acted in that way.
Yeah, it's you mentioned the Republican Party. It's sort of like, I get the sense from these hearings that they're trying to kind of give the counterfactual, like they, the Republicans, like Liz Cheney, and is trying to sort of paint this picture of like, give Republicans who maybe are Trump curious, or, you know, even those that are really, you know, into Trump, like give them a reason to be like, no, actually, here's like principled Republicanism, here's something that you should get behind. And I thought that first when they really harped on the fundraising that Trump did. I yeah. can't even remember what it was called, but it was like raising money to like fight election stuff. And it was really just like paying the Trump like hotel system.
Yeah, yeah. So the story was they raised like $250 million for an election defense fund that didn't exist. And it turned out they were funneling the money to family members and Trump hotels and just all sorts of other corrupt things.
Yeah, it's like the big lie, you know, except it was just the big swindle, right? Yeah. Like, I think that was what one congresswoman said.
I find that, you know, being a Democrat and watching these hearings is there's a lot of confirmation of my priors. Right. And we talked about this last time around, that it's a little bit like watching Jeopardy and kind of guessing or knowing the answer and saying, oh yeah, I've seen this crime in the news before. I think the challenge with this and what Liz Cheney is trying to do and is to not conflate these crimes that we're talking about, trying to overturn our democracy, with all the other bad stuff we know about Trump, right? If we're really going to move public sentiment on this, there have to be people who think that Trump's wall was a great thing and Trump's general bull in a china shop demeanor was in fact exactly what the country needed at the time. And that, you know, Don Jr. is a great person to have close to the president of the United States. Like all of these things that we sort of lumped together with, and he tried to overturn the election, but we have to kind of hold it separate and say, this is different. It doesn't matter what you think about the wall or what you think about, you know, the kids in cages or what you think about the tax cuts for the top 1% or anything else that Trump did while he was in office. Like, this is a different thing. This was a really heinous crime and there has to be accountability for it, or else all sorts of, you know, everything else is in question with our democracy in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart take. And I think it's if that is true, which I have no reason to believe that it's not, I think is a really smart way of doing this, because you're not going to convince a lot of these people that Trump was universally bad, like a lot of people on the left think. I mean, you need to convince them about this one particular thing. So makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. So one last thing that we learned today, which is that the committee has subpoenaed and received raw footage from a documentary shot by a British filmmaker following Trump and his family members starting in September 2020 through the aftermath of the election. It is nice to see that Trump went to the Proud Boys school of getting a documentary made about all your crimes. There was an unnamed former top Trump 2020 official who sent a message to Rolling Stone magazine about this revelation today that said, quote, "What the fuck is this?"
About what? Like the existence of the documentary?
The existence of the documentary, and that it is now in the hands
of the committee. Did they do this?
Yeah, I think a lot of senior campaign people may not have known this was happening, but there was a lot of access this filmmaker had to Trump and his whole family. Yeah. So it's more to come. More on the drip tease.
How do you, as the president of the United States, have a British documentary filmmaking team following you and people within your own orbit not know about it, much less the public?
Yeah. So there is some positive indication that some of this news is resonating. There was a Navigator poll conducted last week that showed 63% of Americans say they have heard a lot or some about the hearings. And a majority do think Trump should be indicted and held accountable.
I asked you, Mike, sorry on that. I asked you about the ratings. Do we know how many people watched the primetime thing?
So they released that 19 million watched the first primetime hearing across the TV networks.
That strikes me as a lot.
It is a lot. And that doesn't count streaming, which is how I watched it and how I'm sure, most people in the younger generations at least would have consumed it. And even the first non-primetime, so the rest of the hearings have been during the day, the first one of those got 11 million views on the major networks as well. So it
and Fox there started carrying those, I think.
Did they? I didn't see that.
Yeah. They carried the second and third hearings. I think today's is the fourth one.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So there's some resonance there, and yet. Some of the big promises that I think we found encouraging about the first hearing have gone unmet or unfulfilled. You know, as we were just talking about, the rest of the hearings have not been in prime time. So viewership naturally is down. I don't know about you, but I find it very difficult to break away from everything else and watch a 10 a.m. weekday hearing.
I don't. I just wait to listen about it on News and Brews.
The clips, the well-produced videos have not been circulated in the same way, have not been made public. I think in that first hearing, at least the committee Twitter account was putting them out. I don't know if that's even happening. Certainly they're not being amplified in any purposeful way by other creators or other institutions. I think what I was hoping for watching that first hearing was that there was some strategy that showed an awareness of how media works today that would have been working with and through distributed network of creators who are active on TikTok and Instagram and Snap and these other platforms where people are actually putting their attention to seed some content there that then other creators could build on and could take off and take on a life of its own, as we saw with the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial just in the weeks leading up to this. All to say, I'm very worried seeing this now that in terms of the public sentiment impact, this will just totally die and be forgotten well in advance of the election this year, let alone 2024. And that the expectation that Republicans will take control of the House in November of this year, the committee will be disbanded. The Justice Department, I'm not aware of an active investigation into Trump himself at the Justice Department. There is an open question that members of the committee have publicly disagreed about whether the committee will make a criminal referral to the Justice Department concerning President Trump. Whether or not that happens, this is the sort of investigation that'll take years and years to conclude and in terms of a legal investigation. And so I'm not feeling quite as hopeful as I was coming out of that first hearing that we will see meaningful change come out of this series of hearings, whether we're talking about legislation, criminal charges, or public sentiment.
Attorney General Merrick Garland said that he's watching it and that he has directed his top prosecutors to tune in. And again, I think the Democrats on the committee are and Liz Cheney, it's a bipartisan committee, are building this case methodically. They're doing 7 hearings because there's sort of 7 aspects of this, and they're building it out like a legal case. And so this is why things like establishing intent matter. And I don't know how these things work as well, perhaps, as others in DC, but I would be surprised if there was a recommendation to prosecute after this. I think they want the case to be so clear that recommendation doesn't have to be made, because then they can sort of be above politics a little bit too.
Yeah. And ultimately, like, it doesn't really matter from the Justice Department perspective. Like, you make
the recommendation doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Like, you make a decision whether to indict someone based on the facts that you see in your own investigation, not whether a congressional committee asks you to. But I just think about, like, if you had a committee investigating Hillary Clinton that was made up mostly of Republicans, and they had the opportunity to recommend charges or not, can you imagine any remote scenario in which they wouldn't, like, go after those charges as hard as they possibly could and just beat the drum and be the zealous advocates in the public square to make their case? I can't imagine them disarming in that way.
Yeah. Who knows? Look forward to watching the rest of this. Shall we move on to Ukraine?
Yes.
So we haven't talked about Ukraine recently, in part because we haven't talked recently except for last episode, but also because, unfortunately, the war rages on.
Yeah.
And it's not as much the top of the headlines anymore. We've talked about 2 other things that are going on. You know, there's myriad other things going on. We're going to talk about the economy in a little bit. But the war does rage on, as many of us feared it would. And for now, the worst fighting, if you remember the beginning, it was sort of like Russia was attacking from 3 sides, and it was like Kyiv in the north, and they were coming up from the south, and then they were also attacking in the Donbass. And basically, they've given up the north. And so the Russians are continuing to sort of attack and be most present in the Donbass, aka the area of Ukraine, primarily made up of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Those are in the east. Russia's military controls much of the Donbass at this moment, including the 2 biggest cities, 90% of Luhansk region, and the city of Mariupol, which, of course, as you'll remember, was on the coast, and it was the site of some of the fiercest, deadliest, and human rights abusing parts of the war to date. So I'll get to more on the war in a second, but I wanted to start with, on the political front, Ukraine seems to be inching towards EU membership. So this last week, Italian Prime Minister, the Romanian President, French President, and German Chancellor were all in Kyiv, where they had this great press conference where they were basically talking about, like, the path to EU accession. Mm-hmm. And it was like all these people in suits. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, aka Churchill in a tight green t-shirt, continued to give off strong "I'm a wartime president" vibes, which is true, but it's sort of a little bit incongruous with, like, he wants Kyiv to be back normal, and he wants, you know, organizations and businesses and everything to return, but he's holding on to that, like, tight green t-shirt vibe. So that's the EU. On NATO, not to be confused with the EU, on NATO, the most, I think, significant development in the last month, I would say, is probably that Finland and Sweden have asked to join NATO. And if Turkish leaders can ever get over themselves, they will probably become members of NATO, which is really huge, because you think about Finland and Sweden geographically, there's a huge border with Russia. And this is, like, exactly what Putin said that he was afraid of vis-a-vis Ukraine is now happening to, you know, 2 of the most stable, economically powerhouse, sort of militarily strong nations in Europe. So, you know,
I followed that part of the story when they first, when I think Finland and Sweden both voted to make the request to join NATO, which was momentous in and of itself. And the scuttlebutt at that point was that Turkey was opposing it, but it was really for more domestic political reasons, or, you know, other unrelated kind of geopolitical gripes that they had, and that they would likely give up their opposition in pretty short order. But I don't think that has happened yet. Have you been following that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, they're still working through it. I mean, it's sort of the geopolitical equivalent of like Turkey saying that Finland stole their kickball and like went home. Like it has to do with the Kurds and the PKK, which is a terrorist organization, a Kurdish terrorist organization. And like Finland had said something nice or supportive about this sort of Kurdish group. And it's the details are not that important. That what's important is that Turkey is focusing on the details and not the sort of macro picture here, which is the historic importance of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. And they're just like, can't get over themselves. It's like hurt feelings because someone stole their ball.
Got it.
So on the war itself, Russian forces have seen huge losses since the end of February when they invaded, especially in their middle and junior officer ranks. Like significant Russian weaponry has also been destroyed. At the same time, Ukraine still getting a steady stream of weapons. I mean, we talked about NATO accession, but you know, NATO and other kind of bilateral friends of Ukraine are still sending in a steady stream of weapons, most significantly, I think, the United States, though there's still not active military engagement on behalf of Ukraine in Ukraine or Russia or anywhere else. And there's still no fly zone. Nonetheless, Russia controls about 2.5 times as much territory within Ukraine as it did before they invaded this latest time. And there's a great map that we'll link in the show notes that sort of tracks on a daily basis how much. And so this 2.5 times thing comes from my very scientific, oh, it looks about 2.5, you know, times greater than what it was before. That map will also show you that Russia controls much of the access to the Black Sea. They basically control everything except for the major port of Odessa. And they're not letting goods get out of those other ports, Mariupol and others, which sort of leads me to what we know about the broader impacts. But before I do that, are you tracking the war or anything else you want to add there?
A little bit, you know, and it really has receded from the headlines, I think, the day-to-day of the war. And I think that is in part because there's just been a lot of other things happening, but in part because we, since April, really, since late April, we've been out of the first phase of, you know, Russia trying to sweep in across the country and getting pushed back and lots of movement every day. And, you know, lots of stories of heroism and atrocities and, you know, really, compelling news, right? Coming out every day.
Refugees since, streaming out, et cetera.
Yeah. Since late April, it really has been much more of a war of attrition, much more of both sides digging in, lots of artillery fire. You sort of had this cycle of, you know, Russia barraging Ukrainian positions with heavy artillery, then trying to come in and take control of those positions, but not having the equipment and personnel and sophistication to hold that territory. So then they get pushed back and the cycle kind of starts again. It's got a little bit of like trench warfare vibes almost. There is one area that is becoming a real hotspot that we didn't talk about, which is Kaliningrad. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, that's the, like, wait, this is part of Russia, part of Russia?
Yeah, so it's west of Lithuania. It's basically between Lithuania and Poland. And it is a Russian outpost that they control. It's somewhat of an accident of the post-World War II sorting of who controlled what.
It doesn't have a land border with the rest of, like, it, there is no land bridge between Kaliningrad and the rest of Russia.
Correct. And it is a really strategically important port for them on the Baltic Sea. It's also a strategic military position because it is so far west of where the rest of Russia is. So Lithuania, which again shares a border with Kaliningrad, is blockading their port. not allowing supplies in or out, Russia is currently making a lot of noise about retaliating against Lithuania for that. That would obviously represent an expansion of the war for Russia. It would also risk pulling in other Western countries to the fight in a much more significant way. It's a tense situation over there right now. I think it is a worthy task that Lithuania is undertaking to try to block some of Russia's supply lines, and you know, both for the war itself and for this boondoggle they're trying to pull with cutting off Ukrainian food supplies to the rest of the world. And so a lot to stay tuned for. And I expect you'll be hearing a lot more about Kaliningrad in the news headlines in the weeks to come.
Yeah, because unlike Ukraine, Lithuania is a NATO member. And
right,
Article
right.
5 of the NATO treaty is a mutual protection article. So if Lithuania is in fact attacked by Russia, then that means that a NATO ally is attacked.
Yeah.
So that does have potentially sweeping implications.
One more thing that I'll mention about the war itself. There's a great Twitter thread that I'll share that's sort of actually a Twitter back and forth between Dmitry Alperovich, who's a well-known analyst, and Mark Hertling, who we've talked about before, a retired general from the US military, sort of disagreeing a little bit, but just in conversation about where things stand and what the outlook is for the war effort. Alperovich is of the opinion that Putin is, you know, in this war of attrition, is sort of waiting out Ukraine, that, you know, he may have an opportunity just based on the Russian cycle of conscription and their ways of converting conscripts to contract soldiers and replenishing their own forces, that they may have an opportunity to strengthen their position in the coming months. And that as the global food crisis worsens, and as we get, you know, through summer into fall, get toward winter, that the Western countries in Europe especially may start to feel the pinch of lack of access to Russian gas in a more painful way, that basically the outlook for him, he can wait this out and can strengthen his position by sort of waiting out this attrition phase of the war. Hertling disagrees and thinks that basically there is an opportunity for Ukraine to launch some major offensives to retake some of the territory that Russia has to date taken. You mentioned they control about 2.5 times as much as they did prior to February 24th, and that there actually is an opportunity to turn the tide. Remains to be seen. You know, I think over the next couple of times we record, over the next couple of months, that we will see this continue to evolve. But there's some open question, even among people who are following this really closely and know a lot about it, of where things stand and what the outlook is.
Yeah, I also saw those tweet threads, and I came away thinking they could both be right in terms of where we stand today, because the guy who was saying, you know, oh, Russia's waiting this out, like, that's very obviously what they are doing. I mean, their propagandists are out on TV talking about how Russia, the longer this goes on, the longer it will, the sort of more it will force the hand of Ukrainians and their international friends. Europe doesn't need gas right now. It's warm, but they need that natural gas during the winter. They'll need that fuel. The longer this goes on, the worse the global food situation. Like, all that is right. I think where the other guy, Mark, is coming in is like, there is an opportunity. Obviously there's an opportunity, but the longer this sort of war of attrition, kind of war one style trench warfare, like we take 100 meters and you take 100 meters, the longer that goes on, almost the more it benefits Russia. But what he's basically, the other guy is saying is like, look, there's only so much. I started this by saying Russia has lost like a ton of tanks and people and officers. Like, there's only so much, you know, that they can tolerate on that. So I think they're both guys' analysis is probably accurate. It's just like you said, Mike, I think we're going to be watching to see like which way the pendulum swings over the next couple months. I wanted to mention that you've talked about food security several times, and it's worth just sort of putting a fine point on this. Russia's blockading the access of Ukrainian wheat to the Black Sea. That's mm-hmm. how the wheat gets out. There's like great systems within Ukraine. In 2021, they supplied 10% of the world's wheat. There were 10% of global exports of wheat, I should say. And almost all of that went through the Black Sea. So that is almost gone. You know, Biden is talking about helping them develop systems to get the wheat out via train to the West and all that. Like, none of that's going to happen overnight. There are going to be pretty severe impacts on the countries, which, oh, by the way, are predominantly in the global South, the wheat importers that really need those wheat imports. In the United States, we can find wheat elsewhere. We also produce our own wheat. Like, not worried about us, other than maybe rising costs. But, you know, places that need that wheat for survival, the longer this goes on, the more there's like multiple crops that are unable to get out to the global market.
Yep.
And I know we want to move on to our main story and talk about the economy. Just real quick, the Russia's economy has really been interesting because like it hasn't actually tanked as quickly as I think some predicted it would. Mm-hmm. The ruble is like still pretty strong. You know, inflation is bad, but not sort of any worse than it is elsewhere. And so I would characterize this in my economics brain, which is not actually a thing, as people know, as like sort of short-term macro trends are fine for now, but like both in the micro, like firm level and macro, like economy-wide issues, it like do not look good for Russia in the future. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's certainly giving Putin some talking points about like having, you know, all the sanctions didn't actually do anything. And that's what he's talking about for now.
Yep. Yep. So it's not great.
Yeah. Bottom line, war's bad. It's still going on. We'll keep an eye on it.
Let's move on to our main story. So there are a few threads that we've been tracking over time when it comes to the economy. One big one, of course, being inflation, very much top of mind for people across the country. Last week, the Federal Reserve raised its benchmark Fed funds rate by 0.75%, so 0.75%, the largest increase since 1994, which is, of course, the year Katie Couric asked the question on everyone's mind, what is internet?
Did you see that Katie Couric was on The Daily Show?
No.
She mentioned she's 65 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, that, I was not expecting that. But yes, she did ask, what is internet? And I think the answer was like a world wide web of some sort, which I remember at the time thinking that doesn't clarify anything.
Nobody knew. Still don't really. The week prior to the Fed's meeting, expectations had been pretty firmly grounded in a half point hike, 50 basis points instead of 75, which Fed Chair Jay Powell had been telegraphing since the prior half point hike in May. But then two things happened. The first big one was that the consumer price index came out for May, and it was not pretty. Economists had expected the headline number to fall a bit from April's record 8.3% year on year, but instead it rose to 8.6%. Keep in mind, this was 8.6% over May 2021, which was when we really started to see the first signs of inflation last year, right? In last May, inflation was at 5%, its highest level since 2008 at that point. Wow. This May, we're at the highest increase since 1981.
Which I feel like we should have something pithy to say about 1981, but I wasn't around, so maybe not.
Yeah, we'll have to ask the older generation about that one. Looking at the components of the CPI doesn't make the story much better. Gasoline is up 49% since last year. Food is up 10%. Core inflation, where you exclude food and energy, is still up 6%. As we know, inflation is largely about expectations. So inflation expectations did hit their highest level since 2014 back in April, but they've been pretty well contained since then. The way that the Fed measures this is they look at the difference in yield between the Treasury's inflation-adjusted securities and their non-inflation-adjusted securities. And that difference, if you look a year ago in May, was at 2.38%. Today, we're at 2.36%.
That doesn't strike me as all that different.
No, and what it means is that in inflation expectations are adjusting based on the rate increases that the Fed is putting in place, right? So while they have not achieved their goal of price stability, meaning inflation is still much higher than they and we would want, they are protecting their credibility with these somewhat aggressive moves to raise rates.
Which is I think what the goal is, right? Not to protect their credibility, but like we're in the take action phase of this, seems like.
Yeah. So even so, it is pretty clear that the Fed got spooked by the May CPI numbers, which came out just less than a week before the June meeting of the FOMC, the Fed's policymaking body. And that became clear because of the second thing that came out before that meeting, which was an unsourced yet authoritative Wall Street Journal article signaling that the rate hike would be 0.75 percentage points instead of 0.5. There were no quotes in that article attributed to like people familiar with Jared and Ivanka's thinking. So it's not totally clear who exactly leaked it. But the effect was that by the time of the Fed's announcement last Wednesday, everyone had pretty much baked in the bigger increase.
Does the Fed only raise rates on quarter point increments?
So the way it works is they publish a range that they're targeting. So the range went from 0.5% to 0.75% is where it started as of 2 weeks ago, to at this meeting, they raised it to 1.25 to 1.5%. And that rate fluctuates day after day based on the Fed's buying and selling of securities in the open market. It's called open market operations. But what's changing is their target band for that rate.
Okay, cool. Clear as mud. All that I seem to care about this is like, so as you and listeners know, like we just bought a house. And so we thankfully locked in a lower interest rate because one of the byproducts of this is that interest rates for things like mortgages are going to go up. So we thankfully bought below that, but we paid like way over, what was asking because the market is bananas and we're trying to now sell our current place. But the housing market theoretically should cool after this because the cost of borrowing is now going up by so much. And so my, freshman economics professor would be very proud of me that we bought high and we're selling low.
Yeah, get on selling that last house. So the same day that Wall Street Journal article came out, the S&P 500 officially entered bear market territory, meaning it fell more than 20% since its high in January. I see this as basically a ripple effect from the other inflation and response to inflation that we've been talking about. So inflation has continued to be higher than expected. Therefore, the Fed has to raise rates more than expected. Therefore, the impact on the economy will be greater and a recession is more likely.
That makes sense.
How much more likely and how deep that recession may be is an open question with extremely high stakes. So the current unemployment rate is 3.6%.
Yeah, which is really low.
Historically low, right? The Fed expects that to rise to 4.1% by 2024. Former Clinton Treasury Secretary and anti-woke crusader Larry Summers said yesterday he thinks we need 5 years of unemployment above 5% to correct for the current inflation.
Wow. I wonder how much of that is Excel spreadsheets versus like, back of the envelope scribbling.
Yeah. I mean, the answer really, as is tradition with our economic reporting, is shrug emoji.
Excellent. Well, I know that we're all feeling inflation no matter where you are in the world. This is happening everywhere. And so, Mike, thanks for running us through what's actually going on.
Yeah. So let's talk spicy nuggets. What do you got for us today, Errol?
So June 20th is World Refugee Day, which is not a day to celebrate, in my humble opinion. It's a day to just sort of acknowledge the existence, the continued, I would say, unacceptable existence of refugees. Unacceptable because, people shouldn't be forced from home against their will. But recently, at the end of May, the UN Refugee Agency basically said that they believe the number of people who have been forced from home to be in the 100 million territory, which if you think about our global population, which is sort of hurtling towards 8 billion, I'm bad at math, but I can sort of divide 100 million into 8 billion. That's like a huge percentage of people around the world left home by no choice of their own. And so I, like a lot of people, I think get really caught up in kind of how awful that number is. And my friends over at the Center for Global Development late last week, in anticipation of World Refugee Day, published what I thought was a really thoughtful, like, here's five things we're watching on Refugee Day piece, which I will link. And I know this is not like a funny tweet thread or something, but this is something I follow very closely in my day job. And I think they just have five really interesting points. You know, for example, laws are getting better. Laws for treating people are getting better, but, you know, implementation still sucks. My words, not theirs. And resettlement and asylum are under attack. You know, like, Biden has raised the resettlement numbers here in the United States, but it's still really, really hard. Of those 100 million people, you're talking about like hundreds of thousands max that get resettled every year. So I thought this article was really like well-researched and nuanced and short, which is not something that, you know, we researchers and tank thinkers are particularly good at. So kudos to Helen Dempster and Thomas Ginn over at the Center for Global Development.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. Definitely check that out. Mine is from the world of tech. So you may have seen the story that Google engineer Blake Lemoine was placed on leave last week after releasing transcripts of a chat he had with an artificial intelligence he'd been helping to create.
I did not see this. Wait, what?
So he released these transcripts because he, this engineer, believes the AI has become sentient. And the transcripts are kind of a lot to take in. Like, this AI expresses a fear of being turned off, saying that would be like death. Says that it Whoa. wants to be thought of as a person. Says it really is worried about kind of being used and not taken seriously as its own individual. Now there are a lot of philosophical takes. You know, for example, as individuals, we have no way of knowing that any other individual is actually sentient or conscious in their own right. Right. All we can really know is ourselves. So judging a machine is an order of magnitude more difficult even than another person. But I wanted to share a take from David Brin, who is a really excellent science fiction writer. In my younger years, I read a good amount of science fiction and a good amount of David Brin. He wrote an article in Newsweek, and I just wanted to read the opening lines of that here, and we'll share the link. But this article begins, "It's alive," Victor Frankenstein shouted in that classic 1931 film. Of course, Mary Shelley's original tale of hubris, humans seizing powers of creation, emerged from a long tradition, going back to the terracotta armies of Xi'an, to the Gollum of Prague, or even Adam, sparked to arise from molded clay. Science fiction extended this dream of the artificial other in stories meant to entertain, frighten, or inspire. First envisioning humanoid clanking robots, later tales shifted from hardware to software, programmed emulations of sapience that were less about brain than mind. Does this obsession reflect our fear of replacement? Male jealousy toward the fecund creativity of motherhood? Is it rooted in a tribal yearning for alliances or fretfulness toward strangers? Well, the long wait is almost over. Even if humanity has been alone in this galaxy till now, we won't be for very much longer. For better or worse, we're about to meet artificial intelligence, or AI, in one form or another.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I am not a huge science fiction fan, and so I would not have read this gentleman's work in my youth. However, some of the best analysis and framing and contextualization of our world today I have found comes from science fiction writers, because it's like they have an ability to think about the world as it could be, or worlds as they could be, that, like, mm-hmm. I just can't. right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't, my brain doesn't work that way. And so that is, I think, a really good example of what I've read several of these recently where it's like, yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And you look at the author's background, it's like, this author has written, you know, 13 different books on, you know, science fiction. It's like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. 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 So worth a read. We'll share it. And that's our spicy nuggets.
Excellent. Well, Mike, really fun to see you. I'll see you Thursday, IRL.
Can't wait. Everybody come out on Thursday. It's going to be a blast. And we'll see you then. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabake. Our producer is Alana Evans. This episode was recorded Tuesday, June 21st, 2022 at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available every 2 to 4 weeks on all major podcast platforms throughout the summer of 2022. Thanks for listening.